You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 322.
On today's show, we talk about ancient Egyptian rock art, a 9,500-year-old cremation, and a Neanderthal skull collection.
Let's dig a little deeper. Collect those skulls. Collect them all.
gotta collect them all.
Welcome to the Archaeology Show.
Hello.
All right. News time.
Yeah. We've got some news this week.
Okay. Well, we are kind of all over the place here, but all this stuff is pretty old, which I like.
Yeah. It is quite old.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This first one is from Live Science, and the title is 5,000-year-old rock art from ancient Egypt depicts terrifying conquest of the Sinai Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to start by just saying, hey, go find the article in our show notes and click on it, because yeah, it starts with a pretty good image that's been sort of outlined to help you see what some of the elements are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you've ever like gone to see rock art or rock art sites, you know, it can be really hard to see the images that are on the panels just because of weathering and light and all kinds of different factors just make them kind of hard to see, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so what they've done in this image, which I don't think I've seen before, is they've actually like outlined all of the key figures on the panel in black so that you can really see them, not just leave. I mean, I've seen the de-stretch stuff. We've talked about that before where they pull out the contrast, you know, but they didn't do that really. They just outlined it, which is really nice. And it's really helpful for seeing what you're looking at.
Yeah, De-Stretch is an app you can just download from the app store. It basically just changes the colors of a picture.
Yeah, like higher contrast or something like that.
Well,
is that kind of
just higher contrast. It's a whole color manipulation scheme.
Okay.
Yeah, to bring things out.
Yeah.
So anyway, I was going to mention the Rock Art podcast because Dr. Alan Garfinkel talks to a bunch of people about things from all over the world. But sometimes when he doesn't have a guest for a certain episode, him and I will get on. And a lot of times in the last few times we've done this, he'll just send me a panel that he's familiar with. And I'm not. And then we'll just kind of discuss what we see in some of the elements. It's really fun trying to put an interpretation on some of this and just pull out some of the details when you're really analyzing it. So take a look at this panel in the images.
Yeah, it's like rock art is really fun, but also like really subjective, right?
Yeah.
Because these are just images. So you don't really know what they meant by them. It's hard to know. Now, this one that we're about to talk about, we do have a pretty good idea of what it means because it's from a culture that's really well documented and we have other images from them. So we can kind of like draw some conclusions, but rock art in general is just really hard to say who, like what they're doing, why they did it and all those kind of questions. So it makes it really fun to speculate, but also like really difficult to draw conclusions.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
This panel was discovered in Egypt. It's about 5,000 years old and was discovered in the Sinai Desert. And what they say is this depicts Egypt's conquest or colonization of the region.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a lot in one panel, to be honest.
It is. And it's like kind of like one key moment that is apparently the conquest. But sure, we'll go with it.
Yeah. The archaeologist in the article here quoted as saying, "It shows in a terrifying manner how Egyptians colonized the Sinai and subjugated local inhabitants." So let's talk about some of the more prominent and important, I would say, images on this panel, because there's kind of a lot on it.
Yeah.
The first thing is a boat. And these are usually associated with Egyptian rulers. Boats serve as a metaphor for a pharaoh in Egyptian rock art and in ancient Egypt. So that's on the far right hand side of the image and in the middle. I think.
I think there's two of them, right?
Yeah.
There's a couple partial images, too, but there seems to be two actual boats.
Yeah.
And then there's also a triumphant standing figure, and they call him triumphant because his arms are raised up over his head. It looks like he's holding some kind of weapon maybe in one of his hands, and that position is generally associated with the god Min. And Min is an Egyptian deity that's associated with fertility and is ruler of the copper area, which I guess one of the things they were going after in this conquest was resources like copper. So yeah, I guess that would be why they would draw an image of that god.
I'm glad our leaders have come a long way in 5 years and we don't, you know, go colonize and subjugate people for resources anymore. Hashtag Greenland. Anyway, so
Hashtag not political.
So another figure right near him is the what they're calling a subdued slash killed figure, because he may be still alive in this image, but he's kneeling, has an arrow in his chest, and his hands are tied.
Yeah.
And they're associating him with the local inhabitants. And I mean, that doesn't get much more clear than that.
Yeah.
A dude standing with his arms raised and one sitting kneeling with an arrow in his chest.
I know. Okay. Looking at that image, though, I'm really struggling to see the hands tied arrow thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because it's just sort of like a primitive drawing, so it's hard to tell what those images are. I do see the thing sticking out of his chest, and I see maybe one arm going behind him, but it's just mm-hmm. really hard to tell what you're looking at. So
yeah.
Again, this is the subjectivity of rock art a little bit, right?
Well, and also the experts that are saying this
yes.
have seen
yeah.
other elements, and they're comparing this with, you know, other things they've seen in Egyptian rock art and stuff like that. So
yeah.
I will point out, too, that there is potentially another figure that they've outlined at the very top of the panel, and that entire section of rock is gone.
Yes.
So there could be a lot more to this panel that we're just not aware
that
of.
That we don't have. Yeah. Yeah.
So we said this was more for resource acquisition, and that's why Egypt was in the Sinai Peninsula.
Mm-hmm.
And they were conducting expeditions into southwestern Sinai.
Mm-hmm.
And it, like I said, it wasn't just for territorial expansion, although that's kind of a byproduct of this,
mm-hmm.
but for the minerals, and namely copper, which we mentioned, and yep. turquoise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that area was mostly occupied by like small nomadic tribes at the mm-hmm. time. So it was a kind of area that they felt like they could move into and conquer fairly easily to
yeah.
to obtain these resources that they were looking for.
Yeah. One of these study authors says that it's one of the earliest depictions of dominance in another territory.
Well, 5,000 years ago, I guess. Yeah. I guess so. Yeah. The article notes that there are other rock art examples in the Sinai from around 5,000 years ago. And they also support the idea that the Egyptians conquered this region at that mm-hmm. time. So, you know, when you have multiple images kind of showing the same thing at around the same time, you can feel pretty sure that they are corroborating each other, mm-hmm. basically.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how they know this, but this next little bit here, the archaeologists in the report state that there used to be an inscription near the boat that mm-hmm. may have named an Egyptian ruler at the time, but it was deliberately erased.
Interesting.
And they're not sure why or when. And that's one of the things you can actually find out through, say, a Descript, because there still might be
like
underlying impressions in the rock art, even though it was kind of scraped away.
Mm, yeah, if they didn't like dig deep enough when they crossed yeah. it out, maybe we could still get to it.
Yeah, for
that would
sure.
be really cool if we could.
Yeah, there are events in Egyptian history where of cases where their pharaoh's name was erased after a new pharaoh came to power.
Yeah, they did. They do have a history of doing that, don't they? Especially yeah. when they didn't like what the previous pharaoh did.
Well,
so
and also these pharaohs were treated like gods.
Yeah,
and they saw themselves as gods. So
yeah.
One came in with a little bigger god complex than the last one, then they'd be like, well, I'm your
yeah.
god now.
So had to establish their authority
yep.
by completely removing the other. But you see it in all cultures, right? Like you see it in Rome or Greece, places where statues have the heads like knocked off and like buried and stuff when a conquering people or group come in, because they want to show their power by taking down the art and sculptures of the whoever was there before them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty common to try and assert your authority by
yeah.
destroying the physical things left behind yeah. by previous groups or rulers or whatever.
Indeed.
Yeah.
All right. Well, they say that they're going to keep looking for more stuff. This is just the beginning of a big research project and a larger campaign. So hopefully they'll find more stuff
mm-hmm.
to either support or tell more of this story, or, you know,
yeah.
maybe tell the other side of the story. But I doubt that.
Doubt that, it's but you can always hope, right?
It's always the people who are left behind that are like, let's put this on the rock art.
Yeah. Victors tell the story.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
All right. Well, for the next article, we're going to stay in Africa, but jump back another just about 5,000 years and talk about a super old cremation, possibly the oldest. Back in a minute. Welcome back to the Archaeology Show, episode 322, and I have to take a moment right now because I was taken to task by one of our longtime listeners to the Archaeology Show for not talking about ancient aliens for episode 321, because I said, oh, there's no rockets or, you know, anything like that, because 321 blast off. Did you know that's the area code in where Cape Canaveral is in Florida?
Yeah.
That's the area code is 321 because 321 blast off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, I was taking a task for not taking that opportunity to say it was aliens. So I'm going to do that now.
Okay, sure.
I
think I missed that email, but
yes. Also, I might as well take a moment now too to mention another longtime listener to the show and frequent commenter, sending us emails all the time, which are great. He was actually a little bit confused and wanted more information on stratigraphy because we had a Strat Chat episode he's like, what's a strat? Well, how do you determine that? What's going on there?
Oh, yeah.
We didn't really explain stratigraphy.
Yeah, we didn't really do that.
Yeah. Okay. And I'll just talk about it real quick because we actually used the word almost a little bit incorrectly in several circumstances because stratigraphy means layers of usually soil.
Like soil stratigraphy is what you're usually talking about.
Yeah. So if you look at the cross section, if you were to take a bulldozer and take a huge chunk of dirt out and then jump down in that hole and look at the wall, you're looking at a top layer with like grass and leaves and stuff on it. Mm-hmm. And then you're looking at a layer underneath that. And then there could be another layer underneath that. And they're very distinct. They're usually very distinct layers of soil because they're different geological time periods. Mm-hmm. Different things formed these layers.
Yeah, they can be wildly different colors. They can be wildly different textures.
Yeah.
Some can have inclusions. Some might not. They might be much smoother. I mean, like you can have lots of different things going on in the stratigraphy.
I mean, maybe at one point in time, the place you're standing on was underneath a lake. And that lake was around for 2,000 years. Yeah. And these little sediment deposits cause these little layers.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe there was a volcanic explosion and there's an ash layer. You know, those are all stratigraphy.
Yeah. And sometimes they are very subtle, too. And you need a really well-trained eye to see the difference in the different strats.
Yeah.
So that can be a complicated part of understanding an archaeological site. But the other impact to an archaeological site, stratigraphy speaking, is that the people might have created stratigraphy that they left behind, like a hearth would be seen directly in the stratigraphy, which is going to come into play here in this article. That's kind of why we're talking about it.
Yeah.
But you would see direct evidence. You'll see a dark, you know, layer of soil if there's a lot of fire activity that was human related or not human related too, which is just another question to answer. Like, why did this fire happen? Was it natural? Was it not natural? So there's, but yeah, the stratigraphy is very interesting and can tell you a lot about a site. And it can also just like make a lot more questions too.
Yeah, and for various research reasons, you'll dictate your methodology and your research plan. But archaeologists will sometimes dig stratigraphically, which means you're going to take everything out in a strat and record it all together as one strat, basically. But if the strats are really deep, you might actually go within maybe 10 or 20 centimeter levels within those strats, right?
Yeah.
So you're going to say, well, this was all strat A, strat B, strat C, or however you're going to label those. And then say, this is strat A1 and the first 10 centimeters, strat A2 and the next 10 centimeters, something like that. So it really just depends on your research methodology in the area and how and why you're going to do that, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So there is no real one answer or one method. It really just depends on the area and what you're doing there. So,
and if you have no idea what we're talking about, go back and listen to our Strat Chat episode.
Yes.
And going forward, we promise to give a little primer on stratigraphy before each of the or during each of those episodes so that we won't leave anybody in the dark again.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
All right. So somebody that was in the dark.
Aww.
For 9,500 years. Although they burned her eyes out. So that's not going to be true.
Oh, God.
Anyway, this article is from Smithsonian Magazine and it's
My
called.
Favorite.
Oh, yeah. Well, not popular. Anyway. Archaeologists say this 9,500-year-old burial is the oldest known evidence of intentional cremation discovered in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So we're talking about Malawi in Africa.
Yeah. Specifically, it is Mount Hora in northern Malawi. And Malawi, for those that don't know, is a landlocked country in southeastern Africa. I didn't know that. I had to look it up, which is why these notes are in here right now.
Yes.
And it sits east of Zambia, south of Tanzania, and north and east of Mozambique. And if you're still lost geography wise, just head over to the map real quick because the countries are, there's just a lot of countries in that area, but that's what we're talking about.
Yeah. I was in Tanzania once.
You were indeed.
I was right next to Malawi.
Oh, you don't say.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Have you mentioned that before?
I've
I don't
never
know if
talked
you,
about
I don't know
that
if you've talked about
once
that
in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just like I've been to Peru.
Yes.
Never talked about that.
search for the Field Archaeologist Survival Guide on Amazon.
Oh,
and you can download my book.
Oh my God.
It actually probably only mentions that once and when I talk about field schools.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. So These remains belong to the Stone Age, and that is a very simple term given so people can understand what that means. Mm-hmm. But the Stone Age is a different time period in different areas.
Yes.
It just means they hadn't really got into metal production or anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, because you get into the Metal Ages after the Stone Ages.
And so, given that this is 9,500 years ago, it makes sense that this would be
not a surprise.
Stone tools only, so the Stone Age. Yes.
So when somebody says they're going to beat you back to the Stone Age or something, then... you're going to Malawi.
Well, in this case, yeah.
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 But the person we're talking about was a middle-aged woman and possibly represents, as the article title indicates, the earliest known evidence of intentional cremation in Africa. I love how they say intentional cremation because I'm sure plenty of people burned alive accidentally.
Yeah, that certainly would have happened in terrible tragedies for sure. But
it also may be one of the world's oldest known in situ cremation pyres for an adult. Yeah,
that's why I found this really interesting, because I think burning as a burial tradition is pretty common in lots of different cultures around the world.
I mean, everybody knows that body's going to stink and rot.
Yeah.
You got to take care of it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's kind of practical, but also part of their ceremonial rituals or whatever. But to have the pyre left behind too, so it's almost like to have the pyre with the remains, they would have had to allow the body to burn and then just walk away.
Yeah.
Or I guess cover it up. Maybe cover it up right where it was and then walk away.
Could be.
But either way, leaving the whole thing untouched, that felt very cool and unique to me.
So this burial was found at a site that they ended up calling Hora 1. It might be Aura. I'm not sure if that's a silent Hora H or however that's pronounced.
Means hour in Spanish. Yeah, but not a Spanish-speaking country, so I don't know.
Definitely not.
No.
But it's a hunter-gatherer site, and that's generally what you're going to find in Stone Age locations is hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
Used for burials for a long time, between 16,000 and 8,000 years ago. So that she wasn't the only person buried there.
No, that's a huge span of time. 8,000 years, that's crazy. Yeah. Previous burials at Hora 1 were complete skeletons, making the large ash layer, which is about the size of a queen-size bed, by the way. So this supposed pyre is highly unusual to be both burned and also... you know, not a complete skeleton like the others. So
they dated this one through radiocarbon dating, and that's where they get the 9,500 year ago time frame.
Yep.
Analysis suggests the woman was, and I love this phrase, physically active, just under 5 feet tall, and burned at temperatures of at least 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm like, those all shouldn't really be in the same sentence.
they really shouldn't.
Yeah. So they're describing her attributes and then, also burned at 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
Well, that's what they can tell from looking at her skeleton. Yeah. So some of those things are her physical attributes and some of them are what happened to her after she died.
Well, and you might be wondering, how do we know that? Because, scientists have burned bodies at different temperatures to see what that looks like.
Yep.
And you know what the effects of certain temperatures will have on certain elements of the human body, from teeth to the bones to other different parts. And it's just when you see this, you're like, okay, well, this had to have burned at least this temperature because we see this happening. Couldn't have burned higher than this because this didn't happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's how we look at it. And then there's enough of her left. You can tell that she didn't burn completely because they can see microscopic cut marks on the bones indicating that some flesh may have been removed before or during the cremation. Jesus, that's brutal. I'm like, did they eat that flesh?
Let's not. No.
Because during cremation is just cooking.
After
the fire's out, that's cremation.
No. There is no evidence
during
for that.
During cremation is There's just, let's bake.
Zero evidence for that. We are not going to go there. No, sir.
There's no evidence of that.
There is not.
But there are cut marks.
But that is interesting. I mean, why are there cut marks?
Listen, flesh was removed.
Yes.
Before or during.
You can tell that it was removed after she was dead. So,
well, yeah, I'm not saying she was alive.
No, that's what I mean. Like, so it was after she was dead. So they're doing it for some specific reason. What is that reason? I suppose you do have to consider cannibalism as a possibility.
You kind of do, though.
You have to, but there's no evidence for that.
Yeah.
But there's also no evidence for anything else either. Like, if it was some kind of weird ritual, maybe they were carving symbols into her skin and that ends up looking like carved off flesh. Like, there could be some like decorative reasons that they were doing
it. I think they can tell because there's no healing involved, right?
Well, but
to the marks.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah. But those marks could have been flesh removal, or it could have been just markings into the flesh, too, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, maybe they were making a stew because the skull is missing.
The skull is missing, which is also
flip that over. You've got a bowl. They didn't have bowls.
No,
no. This is the Stone Age.
Again.
So no pottery. Anyway, yeah, we're not saying there was cannibalism. Nobody said that.
We're not.
But you also can't not talk about it. So.
You can say it's possible.
Listen, people are hungry. And when you're hungry and you're like, I mean, that doesn't smell bad. So anyway, the skull was missing, though.
Yeah.
And they said it was, they believe it was deliberately moved, which all these little indicators here tell me that there was a significant amount of bones left.
Yeah. Which means I think that 1,000-degree fire is not enough to truly burn a human. So,
truly not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have a lot left.
Yeah. A lot of her, probably all of her flesh burned and things like that. But yeah. Just like,
but the bones. Bones need so much intense heat for a really long time.
And if you're like, how do they know it wasn't violence or cannibalism that removed the head or caused the skull to be removed? And they just literally said cannibalism. The reason they would know that is because, I mean, if somebody was to literally lose their head in a battle or something like that, you're going to see some
trauma.
Some violent removal of the skull. But if she was in the process of being burned or on the pyre and they sort of gently with stone tools removed her head.
Yeah.
That's going to look very different.
And it could be that after she burned, after the flesh burned away, they removed the skull at that point too. They don't really specify. And actually, I would be interested to know, because I would think that they'd be able to tell that potentially by looking at where it would have joined the neck if it was removed because the bones had disarticulated after the flesh burned away, or if there were cut marks there. They don't really talk about that, but that would be interesting to know.
Yes. And another couple of interesting points is this cremation, it's not like cremations today, which I don't know how long they take, but I'm guessing maybe only a couple hours at best, if not way less than that.
I think so, because they have such a hot fire.
These official cremation places, they might just have that fire burning all the time. I don't really know how that works. Like, if you're doing lots of cremations, I guess, you know, does the fire ever go out? But anyway, they found the bones in two clusters, the remains, suggesting the body was actually moved during cremation. So they're like, ah, crap, move it over. But because they said it would have required significant effort using an estimated 70 pounds of wood and grass and burning for hours or days even.
Yeah. I mean, burning a body is hard. I listen to a lot of true crime podcasts. I've heard about some, I've listened to accounts of failed efforts at burning human bodies.
This is why we need to be a video podcast, because I'd be blinking right now to try to signal my distress.
Are you doing
yeah,
this one?
Yeah, I'm doing the hand symbol.
The hand signal to save me. No, I find human violence super interesting, both in the past and in the present. So it's just so interesting. The things that people do to each other is crazy and terrifying. But anyway, that might be crazy. That's fine, though.
It might, actually.
So, but what I do know is that it takes a lot of fuel and a lot of time and a lot of heat to burn a body.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they might have found that one part was burning hotter than another, and they moved part of her remains to help it burn better. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But yeah, definitely. Somebody was tending this fire, though, to keep it alive and keep it burning. So that's just another interesting thing here. Like, they didn't just set it on fire and walk away. Somebody was in charge of making sure this thing kept going and that it did what they wanted it to do, which is its care and interest and something that we don't know exactly that they put into this cremation.
For sure.
Yeah.
Before this discovery, Africa's oldest known burned human remains dated to about 7,500 years ago, with confirmed cremations only around 3,300 years ago. Mm. So they did find, again, burned human remains, but then they weren't sure if that was a cremation or not. And they had confirmed ones 3,300. So, I mean, this just says, with the, I would say, relative sophistication of this one from 9,500 years ago, that this wasn't their first rodeo.
Oh, definitely not.
Yeah.
It couldn't have been.
Yeah.
I mean, it could have been a developing idea, though, because the fact that there's so much of the bones intact still, and that they moved the body multiple times. The skull is missing. Like, they could have been experimenting with different types of burial rites. So and that there's only one of them, too, is also interesting. Like, was this person more important? Is that why she got this really special burial? Maybe she was in trouble for some reason. Mm. Maybe there was a negative reason why they decided to treat her remains in this manner.
Who knows?
We don't know. But it's really interesting to speculate and think about it.
Possibly just haven't found everything, too.
That's true. Yeah.
Yep. They're still going.
Yep.
So globally, older cremations do exist. This isn't the oldest in the world. Lake Mungo in Australia has some older ones.
Mm-hmm.
But adult in situ pyres are extremely rare. So this is unique in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
Repeated fires at the site suggest long-term cultural significance and a strong attachment to this place among hunter-gatherers.
Oh, yeah. For like eight. Also, the fact that there are 8,000 years worth of burials at the site. Like, clearly they were returning over and over. So this is something, some kind of importance here for sure. And researchers believe the discovery reflects advanced belief systems and social complexity in these early hunter-gatherer communities. And I'm like, yeah, duh. Like, yeah. This feels like every single discovery just adds to this idea that they're more complex than they have given credit for in the past by past researchers. And just as we find more evidence, it's clear.
Yeah, they're going to keep doing excavations here, hopefully, and try to figure out a little more about her and her life and what the significance of this type of cremation is and this cremation in general is to that community that lived there.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, we're going to keep talking about skulls and go back 43,000 years for the next article. Back in a minute. Welcome back to segment three of episode 322 of the Archaeology Show. And now we're going to a live science article. And this one is entitled, "More than 43,000 years ago, Neanderthals spent centuries collecting animal skulls in a cave." But archaeologists aren't sure why. We're never sure why. Yes. All right. So take a look again at this article, because the first picture in here is, you know, it looks like a friggin' Texas trophy room.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. It's a lot of horns from various antlered animals.
Yeah.
And it seems that these were collected and replaced by Neanderthals repeatedly over and over, over a long amount of time in the Descubierta cave in central Spain. And this is Neanderthal, so we're talking, you know, like you said, 43,000 years ago.
I mean, I'm going to correct you a little bit here. Those aren't antlers. Those are...
Oh, it's horned and antlered animals. Yeah. You see, look in the picture.
There's
you'll see
one
a couple...
antler.
There's a couple antlers there.
There might be two.
Yeah.
All right. But they are from skulls from steppe bison, aurochs, which are super cool, rhinos, and red deer.
Yeah, so, deer. Antlers.
Yeah, whatever.
Thank you.
Yep, true. Okay, so like you said, Spain, 43,000 years ago, they uncovered actually 35 large mammal skulls, mostly missing jaws because it's hard to keep the jaw together. It does separate
it
from the skull.
It does separate because your mandible and the rest of the skull are not connected. But it does beg the question of, did they do it on purpose? Did they not want the jaws for some reason and they only wanted the top antler part?
I mean, maybe, but they didn't have any way to like wire them together. They had fabric and... you know, things like that. But why would they hook the jaw back in? I think they just took the skull because it was easier.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But they could have taken both pieces is what I'm saying.
Well, they could have. Yeah. So, but there was also found in association with this over 1400 Mousterian stone tools. Mousterian is just the time period, which identifies the tool types and the time periods for that area.
Yeah. It's the middle Paleolithic stone tool tradition, which are, of course, linked to Neanderthals. It makes sense. This is a Neanderthal site and they're found across Europe, Western Asia and North Africa.
You know, I often forget how far some of those tool traditions go because I get really irritated when we think about Clovis in North and South America because Clovis is all over the place. It's the only tool that we have besides Folsom, possibly, that we use one term for this tool shape and this technology across an entire continent.
Yeah.
And yet we've worked all over the United States and we've seen very similar, much later tools. And they all have different regional names. But
they
I'm
do.
Like, you could easily call this the same thing in Nevada as you found in North Carolina.
There's a lot of very similar ones, for sure. Yeah.
But Clovis, for some reason, it's just like, oh, well, this is Clovis. Clearly, it's not, you know, Pittsburgh Clovis.
Yeah. Well, it's because we find so few of them, too. So there's not been enough of them to kind of develop a regional difference in the profiles, I don't think.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know. I just get a little crazy about that. But then it might come from different schools of thought, too, that the Mousterian tool tradition crosses several continents.
It does.
You know,
yeah.
And lots of big areas here. So,
yeah. And they were a really interesting tool type. Just a little bit more about them.
Yep.
They're produced from prepared cores rather than large bifacial hand axes, which were typical of earlier tool industries. So that's one difference.
Yeah, a hallmark of these is the Lavois technique, they call it, which is just a technique for taking off these cores, for removing these flakes from these cores, basically. And it makes them standardized shapes, these flakes.
Yeah.
And actually, the flakes taken off and the cores themselves were actually useful in certain ways. So,
yeah, but it just kind of like standardized tool making a little bit for these individuals. And then they could like quickly and easily make the thing that they needed in the moment.
Yeah, and one thing that this shows is that the people who were doing this, the Neanderthals in this case, were, and I do say people when I say that, they are Homo Neanderthalensis.
I kind of struggled under that earlier because I mean, do I call them people? I don't know. Let's say individuals.
They're not people in the sense that we are today.
Yeah, they're not modern humans, obviously.
Yeah, they're still, I feel like they're still people.
Look at the amazing things that they're doing. And then research over and over in the last decade just shows how amazing they were.
They had the first clothing, the first musical instruments, the first burials.
Yeah.
Who did it first? You know,
the Neanderthals did, obviously.
But as opposed to their earlier ancestors, this Lavoie technique in the Mosterian tool tradition is just a method that shows that they had more systematic planning in the creation of these tools than earlier traditions, mm-hmm. right? Because it does take some real thought to take a rock and get these pieces off just like that. You have to actually prepare the core quite heavily before you can start taking flakes off.
Yeah.
So.
And I think it's really important that we add the context of what kind of tools these people were mm-hmm. using to this article, because it just adds more weight to the fact that they were collecting these skulls probably for a very specific reason.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they have been? They were creating these tools very specifically, and they had a really systematic way of producing them.
Yeah.
So the other things that they were doing in their life, there's no reason to suspect that it was random chance or some kind of thing that they did as a one-off, you know, because that's always been the argument is we need to see more examples of this. It's do you? We know these people were amazing, doing amazing things. So,
yeah. And one reason, just to go a little bit different direction here, that we don't like, and I say we archaeologists don't like pot hunters and people who are out there just hunting for things to either maybe collect sometimes, but mm-hmm. often sell, is they like to just dig until they find the cool stuff and then mm-hmm. throw everything else away, right? Well, this cave deposit, like a lot of cave deposits, has jumblings in and around itself with the natural rock falls that come down from the cave and cultural deposits.
Yeah.
And so the researchers here had to really carefully dig through all this stuff, documenting everything they found in three dimensions,
mm-hmm.
measurements, photographs, everything, so they could create this distinction in their layers between geological processes and human activity.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're just seeing this jumble of stuff and you're like, I can't make heads or tails of this.
It doesn't make any sense until you start mapping things. Yeah. And the stratigraphy, as we were talking about, comes into play because you really need to understand what is under what, you know, what is mixed together, what came first, what came after. And that'll help you build this picture
mm-hmm.
of what was natural and what was human.
Yeah, and skulls were collected in this area over a very long period, from about 135,000 years.
So long.
To 43,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And it looks like it was mostly during colder climate phases. Mm. So kind of makes me think this was more of a ritualistic thing. And they mm-hmm. thought, hey, maybe if we bring skulls over here, we can bring, you know, warmer times back.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, maybe.
They were like, winter has been here long enough. We need summer now.
Or maybe this area was just better for hunting during colder times,
why
too.
Bring the skulls and nothing else?
Well, yeah. Who knows?
So that tells me there's more ritual involved.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were placed in, this also tells me that, they were placed in specific areas of the cave repeatedly
mm-hmm.
over, I mean, when you're talking about literally thousands of generations.
Yeah.
I mean, and they're all doing the same thing. This is a handed down cultural information.
Yeah.
And it's just, it suggested that this whole practice of collecting these skulls specifically and putting them there was sustained across all these generations.
Yeah.
I mean, this is handed down information.
Yeah, totally. Clearly. Yep. And the cave does not appear to have been a living space at all. And what we mean by that is cooking activity or anything involved in creating food or clothing or all the other things you need to sustain life.
Mm-hmm.
There's none of that evidence there. So it doesn't seem like this behavior was tied to all those things that you have to do to basically just live day by day. None of that.
So because this has all been clearly something symbolic to these guys, but we actually don't know the real purpose of the mm-hmm. collection of the skulls, and we probably never will.
No, it's could you? Yeah,
I know. It meant something to them. And like I said, I have a feeling that There was only a handful of things these people are actually concerned with. They were concerned about the weather because that was their livelihood.
Yep.
And these were collected in colder climatic periods. So mm-hmm. that tells me that it could have been tied to the weather.
Yeah.
But also, like you said, they also often do ritualistic practice like this, whether it's rock art or things like this involved with hunting.
Mm-hmm.
And when the climates are colder, maybe the animals moved away. Mm-hmm. Maybe there were fewer animals because mm-hmm. some of them, you know, went to warmer temperatures.
Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe they thought this would help, you know,
like call them somehow. Back or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how that would work, though. It's like, hey, here's a pile of your ancestor's skulls. Why don't you come back?
If you have this, if you have this like reverence for the animal, like a lot of indigenous communities that we know from modern mm-hmm. indigenous communities that they do this reverence, this respect, you know, in that way, maybe it would be calling them back because they are like, we want to respect you by hunting you and eating you.
They're like, oh, yeah, sign me up, bro. I don't think the animals felt that way.
It feels a little bit like contradictory, but I totally see why that would be in their heads. I love it.
Yeah. All right. Well, this just is one more piece of evidence that Neanderthals had their own distinct systems of meaning and cultural practices mm-hmm. different than those of Homo sapiens they were literally living next to.
Yes. Yeah. And there was probably crossover between them too in sharing of knowledge, and they weren't just the cavemen down the street. It was they were much, much more than that. I love these stories. I love just having more of these puzzle pieces get put into place.
Which, to play devil's advocate just a little bit, Mousterian tool traditions are largely associated with Neanderthals.
Correct.
But like, if there's actual Homo sapiens living in the area and they saw these tool techniques and they saw these guys doing this, would they not maybe attempt the same thing if it works? You know, but you just don't find these associated with Homo sapiens sites a lot.
Yeah, you don't.
It's really interesting.
And you don't find a lot of crossover sites with both early human and Neanderthal activity mm-hmm. together. They clearly lived separately, but we also know they clearly did mix because modern people today have some small percentage of Neanderthal DNA in them, right?
Yeah.
So there was mixing, there was interaction, but it definitely wasn't like daily enough that we see mm-hmm. it in the archaeological record.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting question on how much information sharing was going on between those groups.
Yeah.
Because that's not been revealed to us yet from what we know. True. I don't think. Not really. Maybe people who are really into it have a better idea, but
yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. It's very cool. So much to learn and know and study. I love this stuff.
Yes. All right. Well, I think that's all we have on this topic.
I think so.
Yeah. It's a couple of that was a few good news stories. I like the really old stuff. That's what really interests me. But
yeah, it's super cool.
All right. Thanks a lot. And be sure to email in. Our email addresses are on the show notes for these episodes. So go take a look at that. And I'll give you a little primer, too. We have a new digital product store coming out very soon on the ArcPodNet website. Mm-hmm. So we'll be releasing that as you're listening to this in middle of February 2026. We'll be releasing that very soon, and mm-hmm. you'll be able to get at the very minimum some wallpapers for your phone and things like that, and everything helps support us and keep the lights on over here. So go check that out. We'll announce it on our socials. Follow us on Instagram at ArcPodNet, and we have a newsletter that you can sign up for when you go to our website, and then we're on all the other socials that I can possibly think of at ArcPodNet, but mostly Instagram. So mm-hmm. all right, with that, we'll see you guys next time.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at ArcPodNet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. Thanks for listening to this podcast. The Archaeology Podcast Network's chief editor is Rachel Roden. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media and newsletter coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. The APN was founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle on December 1st, 2014. We're supported by our amazing podcast hosts, many volunteers, and listeners like you. Check out membership at www.arcpodnet.com/members.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.